The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Cancer in Women, Breast, Uterus, and Ovary is presented by Dr. Kevin Hubbard. We'll talk next about breast cancer. For women, it's the most common occurring malignancy in the United States, over 240,000 cases per year. Second cause of cancer death in women, lung cancer, of course, being first. Median age of diagnosis is 55, so this is a disease of middle-aged women. Men do get this, but only 1% as often as women do. On average, one woman in eight will develop breast cancer in her lifetime. So the risk factors for development of breast cancer would include older age, a family history of breast cancer, and that family history may increase the risk for cancer at an early age. So if they give you a case of a woman who comes in and she's 35 and she's got breast cancer, you want to think about some of those family histories that we talked about with genetics. You also want to think about something else that maybe you're missing, but that's somebody who we need to explore her history in a little bit greater detail. Early menarche and late menopause, possibly a high-fat diet, oral contraceptive or estrogen replacement. Those are things that would increase your risk as well. And here's some of those cancer family syndromes that we've talked about before, and I've just kind of put them back in here so that you've at least got it in front of you as you go through and review this again. But think about those cancer family syndromes. Think about the breast cancer susceptibility genes, BRCA1 and BRCA2. BRCA1, it's altered in 5 to 10% of women with breast cancer under the age of 40. BRCA2 is similar, and when it's mutated, may pose an 85% lifetime risk for breast cancer and a 10% lifetime risk for developing ovarian cancer. Angelina Jolie, who was in the public eye a few years ago, had a BRCA2 mutation, and she opted for some of the surgical options that she did in an effort to minimize her risk of contracting breast cancer and ovarian cancer. It may also, interestingly enough, be responsible for most cases of male breast cancer. There's some studies out there that male breast cancer, and since it's not a common disease in men, we don't have huge studies to look at, but probably 50 to 60% incidence of BRCA2 positivity in men who have breast cancer. So some important information that you might find helpful on the exam. The HER2 oncogene is a member of the type 1 growth receptor family, and it's present in about 25% of all breast cancers. We used to think that this was an adverse prognostic factor, but as it turns out, it's a target for some of our targeted therapies, and patients who have HER2 overexpression actually have outcomes that are comparable to that of women who are HER2 negative now. So we're very fortunate in that regard. We do look at grade in terms of understanding how to best approach this. It does describe the level of aggressivity of the tumor specimen. I would think that if they're going to give you questions on the board exam, they will use terminology rather than saying grade 1, grade 2, grade 3. That doesn't give you a whole lot of information. Poorly differentiated. Now that's information that's clear, it's not equivocating, and on the boards I do think that they strive to try to be that clear. So I think it's going to help you understand that the more aggressive it is, the poorer the differentiation, the more aggressive it's going to be. Surgery typically involves lumpectomy along with a margin of surrounding normal tissue. Oftentimes, lymph node sampling will be conducted. In many cases, axillary lymph node dissection is preceded by an evaluation for sentinel lymph node. And so sentinel lymph node testing and mapping can be very helpful in that regard. So those women with negative sentinel lymph nodes, they don't have to undergo axillary lymph node dissection. If they have sentinel lymph node positivity, then a formal axillary lymph node dissection is undertaken. So the women who need the dissection can benefit from it. The women who don't need the dissection can be spared some of the potential long-term complications of axillary lymph node dissection. Radiotherapy is valuable in management of patients with breast conservation. Women who have small tumors can be treated with brachytherapy. It's known as mammocytes, a little balloon. And it's a, what we call an afterloading device. It gets placed, and then after it's in place, the radiation oncologist administers the treatment right through the balloon. And that's an alternative to external beam radiation therapy. Local radiation, though, of some sort is going to be required in all patients who receive a lumpectomy, and that's the key. It's also of value for palliative intent in women who have breast cancer metastases, as we've already mentioned. Chemotherapy, well, there are more drugs available to treat breast cancer than pretty much any other malignancy out there, and I've listed some of the more commonly used agents here. In most cases, we will use combination therapies up front. If there is evidence of progression or there is failure of those therapies to control disease in those women who continue to desire treatment, we will oftentimes switch to regimens that have perhaps just one or two agents in an effort to minimize side effects and toxicity. Most of our regimens are going to be either anthracycline-based, where we're using doxorubicin or epirubicin as the backbone, or taxane-based, where we're using either docetaxel or paclitaxel as the backbone. In many combinations, we will utilize one from each category, a taxane and an anthracycline, to treat the cancer itself. Hormonal therapy really found its niche in breast cancer, and 67% of postmenopausal women will have estrogen and or progesterone receptors on the surface of their tissue, whereas only about 10% of premenopausal women will have hormone receptor positive tumors. And so this is a postmenopausal situation in most cases. We've got tamoxifen as our chief agent in terms of blocking estrogen receptors. It's an estrogen receptor antagonist, but beware that it's also a partial agonist. And so in women who have evidence of bony metastases, if you put them on tamoxifen, you may find that their bone pain gets worse. They might have a spike in their calcium levels. They may feel very, very bad for a couple of weeks before the deprivation benefit at the level of the tumor begins to take effect and the tumor begins to shrink. So it's something to be aware of. Also, you need to be aware that tamoxifen can potentially increase the risk of endometrial cancer, and so yearly gynecologic examinations are required in any woman who has an intact uterus who is on tamoxifen. We also have aromatase inhibitors, and anastrozole is probably the most commonly used agent nationwide. It decreases conversion of androgens to estrogen in the adrenal glands, only of value in women who are postmenopausal. We also have a couple of other agents that can work in the line of aromatase inhibition, letrozole and exemestane. We've done some things over the years to look at switching strategies. And so they might give you a patient who, say, has been on tamoxifen for a couple of years. Tamoxifen can be thrombogenic because it is a partial estrogen agonist. Some of the risk of thromboembolic disease goes along with that. And so a woman might come in, she's been on tamoxifen for 2 or 3 years, and she comes in with a DVT. And you get asked, what would you recommend as far as changing her medication around? Well, you can't continue tamoxifen in a setting like that. It's contraindicated. So you could switch her to an aromatase inhibitor, still give her the reassurance that she's going to get effective therapy, and you would plan to finish out her course of therapy on the aromatase inhibitor. So they might give you a question like that. So this is how things might play out. And so just kind of trying to set the stage for what might become an issue in a situation like that. Well, how long do you need to be on tamoxifen? Well, there have been several trials looking at this, and it seems that if you're on tamoxifen for a period of 10 years, it lowered the recurrence rate in the second decade after diagnosis by nearly 50%. In the second decade after diagnosis, so let's say that woman is 50, she stays on until she's 60, that stuff is still giving her benefits when she's 70. Pretty amazing information. And so consequently, tamoxifen is utilized for 10 years in women who are likely to benefit most. And that would be women who are under the age of 70 or have a life expectancy of more than 15 years. We don't have long-term data sets on aromatase inhibitors beyond 5 years, but it's coming. I think it's too soon to bring into a board review course, but just so when you get home, if anybody asks or you're in that situation in the next few weeks, those studies are maturing, and we should have some information available probably within the next year or so. So breast cancer is a heterogeneous disease. There's more than one way to treat it, and it's important to keep that in mind. Our major focus of non-metastatic cancer is cure. Our major focus of metastatic breast cancer is palliation. So if you kind of keep that in mind as you're taking care of these things, looking at the scenarios, that would be good to kind of have in mind as you approach which questions might be beneficial. So let's take a look at a couple of scenarios that you might encounter on the boards regarding breast cancer. So they give you a patient who's got a small primary, she's lymph node negative. What can you do? Well, breast conservation followed by radiation therapy would be very appropriate. And you would consider some sort of adjuvant systemic therapy if she has a tumor that's a centimeter or more in size, or if she has multiple adverse prognostic features. So high grade, there's necrosis, there's lymphovascular invasion, some of those things. Those would be situations where you'd kind of think we're going to need to do something adjuvantly. Let's say they give you a patient with lymph node positive breast cancer. The thing you want to think about here is how big is the primary lesion. If it's 4 or more centimeters in size, it can be managed by mastectomy, or we can administer preoperative chemotherapy, shrink it down in the hope of breast conservation. Adjuvant systemic therapy is going to be indicated in every case where you've got lymph node positivity in a situation like that. Let's say they give you a case of locally advanced or inflammatory breast cancer. Here, multimodality therapy is the key. Chemotherapy initially, we're trying to get this thing to shrink and help. Surgery, radiation therapy would be considered after that. And then we'd base the decision for additional systemic therapy as indicated. So kind of think your way through that, but the chances are pretty good that you're going to make the right decision based on what they present you if you keep these general guidelines in mind. For metastatic breast cancer, surgical treatment of the breast is not required, but patients may gain some psychological benefit from mastectomy. And we've seen studies where we've seen women who have undergone a removal of the primary breast, and they will come in and they say they just feel better. So it may be that a reduction in tumor burden is helpful. Remember, cancers are things that secrete all sorts of chemicals into the body. So it's dumping a lot of junk in the bloodstream. If you debulk that situation, perhaps there's some psychological benefit, but perhaps some of those nasty things that the tumor's making, their levels are lower now, and patients just feel better because of that. It's a possibility. So you don't have to surgically treat the breast, but it is an option if there's a patient who really feels like she would benefit from something like that. We treat these patients for palliative intent. So the disease course here can be extremely variable. You just kind of have to see what they give you, but chances are pretty good. If they give you a question like this, it's going to be something along those lines, and hopefully now you've kind of got some framework. I do think they will probably ask you some sort of question about ductal carcinoma in situ. I would freely admit that some of those scenarios, it's real easy to say, well, you just let the oncologist deal with it. And admittedly, that's why we're here. But this is something that primary care physicians have land in their offices and clinics all the time. Ductal carcinoma in situ, we do know that the diagnosis is increased with the extensive use of mammograms, microcalcifications, those sorts of things have really brought this to life. We've got the comedocarcinoma and the non-comedo types to consider here. Most of these patients will do well with lumpectomy plus radiation. Post-lumpectomy radiation, tamoxifen has reduced the risk of breast cancer in both the ipsilateral breast and the contralateral breast. Simple mastectomy is certainly an option. Radiation is going to be required. You have to pretty much do something in the case of extensive DCIS. A lot of people feel that simple mastectomy is still the best way to go in that particular situation. Lobular carcinoma, hard to figure this one out. It's not considered cancer, but it's a marker of increased risk for developing invasive breast cancer. It's also known as lobular neoplasia or atypical lobular hyperplasia. If you see that on a thing, kind of think about this situation. It's usually multicentric and bilateral. When I was growing up, oftentimes we would do mirror biopsies of both breasts because it was bilateral. 21% chance of developing breast cancer in 15 years. So it is a precursor lesion. Close follow-up is important. Clinical breast exams every 4 to 12 months, annual mammogram. You can consider tamoxifen with this group as well. Bilateral prophylactic mastectomy in selected patients would be the consideration. Breast reconstruction, they may ask you about that. And I think women by and large will feel that they get very good results. In most surveys where we've asked women what their perception is, breast reconstruction is either given very good to excellent responses about 85% of the time. Some women just don't want to go through the surgery and the hassle, and they would prefer to wear a breast prosthesis. Those are things that are certainly available to them. You might get a question about breast cancer prevention. We've talked a little bit about that. You want to encourage modifications that are known to decrease likelihood of developing breast cancer. So tamoxifen and raloxifene are the two agents that we can consider. The problem with raloxifene is it doesn't decrease the risk of in situ carcinomas. So that's a potential concern. It's a dialogue that really the patient and physician need to have together. We're going to turn next to endometrial carcinoma, talk a little bit about it. Why might it show up on the boards? Well, because it's the most common gynecologic cancer out there, about 60,000 cases per year. 75% of these are going to occur after the age of 50, only 4% prior to age 40. And as we've mentioned, it can be hereditary in certain families. Rate is increased in industrialized societies. We know that the risk of adenocarcinoma is increased with a lot of things that tend to increase the risk of breast cancer. Obesity, unopposed estrogenic stimulation, hyperinsulinemia. So think about those hyperinsulinemic states. We're talking about insulin resistance and things of that nature. Anovulation, Stein-Leventhal syndrome, premature ovarian failure, and of course the family cancer syndromes. Atypical adenomatous hyperplasia is a precursor lesion for carcinoma of the endometrium. Here the risk is about 10 to 30% at 10 years if it's not treated. Tamoxifen, as I've mentioned, risk is slightly increased. Yearly gynecologic examinations, and you want to investigate any vaginal bleeding in any woman taking tamoxifen. That's a concern. Adenocarcinoma is going to occupy about 90% of these. Other types you can see, clear cell carcinoma, small cell carcinoma, leiomyosarcoma, rare, but if you're going to have one, a habit of the muscle, it's going to be leiomyosarcoma. Lymphomas are also a possibility as well. Now, most of these patients early on are going to be asymptomatic with vaginal spotting or vaginal bleeding the most frequent complaint. Such complaints really warrant an investigation, because if you just take an unselected population of women who come in who are postmenopausal that have vaginal bleeding or spotting, risk of malignancy in that situation is about 35%. So one person in three is going to be found to have some sort of malignancy. In more advanced cases, you're going to have pelvic fullness or pain, and you'll have some constitutional symptoms as well. So fatigue, weakness, weight loss, flu-like sensation, that sort of thing. Ascites can be present in more advanced stages as well. You make the diagnosis with aspiration curettage. It's most often employed, but the challenge that we faced is it really doesn't seem to be able to detect those precursor lesions. Dilation and curettage is accurate in about 90% of cases, but now you're in a situation where you have a surgical approach. So that's the challenge that we have, is that there's really no good way to screen women for endometrial carcinoma. We tell them to go and get their yearly gynecologic examinations, but short of doing something like at least an endometrial biopsy, it's really difficult to pick these things up, particularly those precursor lesions, part of our challenge. We follow the FIGO criteria for staging. So staging is completed surgically in most cases, but some additional studies might help. So think about things like CBC and tests of liver and renal function, chest x-ray, CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis, pelvic ultrasound may be helpful in that situation as well. Tumor grade plays a role in the treatment of stage one disease. We'll talk about that here right now. So for stage one disease, now with stage one disease, this would be disease that's confined to the uterus itself. So no evidence of any sort of local advancement or distant metastases. Those women are treated with total abdominal hysterectomy, bilateral salpingo oophorectomy. If they have evidence of involvement of outer half of the myometrium, there is a greater risk of pelvic lymph node involvement. So those women will undergo a pelvic lymphadenectomy. We would consider adding radiation therapy postoperatively if there is involvement of the outer half of that myometrium, or there's grade 3 histology. Now, in a separate case, if the lymph nodes are involved, that's technically stage 3 disease. So just so that you are aware of that. For stage 2 disease, now we often will have involvement of the cervix itself and potentially involvement of the vagina. So here we have to include the perimetria, the vagina, and the pelvic lymph nodes. So these women get an extended total abdominal hysterectomy, bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy, just a larger in-block resection, along with radiotherapy, which consists of vaginal brachytherapy, followed by external beam pelvic radiation therapy. For stage 3 disease, now we have disease that's extensive throughout the endometrium itself, involves the cervix, and can be locally advanced into the fallopian tubes and potentially other structures. Because of that, the treatment is total abdominal hysterectomy, bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy, with pelvic and periaortic lymphadenectomy and omentectomy, a more aggressive approach because those areas are potentially at risk. We'll administer chemotherapy adjuvantly, followed by radiation therapy, and we've got essentially cisplatin and carboplatin, kind of platinum doublets that we will utilize in that setting for a period of about 4 to 6 months after completion of their treatment. For stage 4 disease, this disease is mostly treated for palliation. Chemotherapy can be given for control of symptoms. Regrettably, it doesn't work quite as well as it does in the earlier stages. Radiation therapy with or without hormonal therapy, certainly an option for chemotherapy. There's a limited role for surgery. Most of the time, we'll try to do it in order to avoid obstruction of the hollow viscera. And we'll talk lastly about ovarian carcinoma. They really seem to get attracted to ovarian carcinoma on the boards. And so this is a pretty target-rich environment here. Ovarian carcinomas arise from epithelial tumor tissue 75% of the time. 5% of these are germ cell tumors, but those germ cell tumors are going to account for 2/3 of all ovarian malignancies in women under 20 years of age. So if you have a young woman who comes to see you, think in terms of an ovarian germ cell tumor, not very common. 22,000 cases and 14,000 deaths per year attributable to ovarian carcinoma. It's more common in westernized cultures. The median onset is a little bit younger than the other carcinomas. It's about 48 years. Half of them are going to occur in women over the age of 65. So important to kind of keep that in mind, middle-aged and older women. What decreases the risk of developing ovarian carcinoma? And these are questions that they love on boards. They love these at the NBOME level too. So if you kind of remember these, they talk about what decreases the risk, what increases the risk. For some reason, they really get attracted to those things. So the things that decrease the risk of developing ovarian cancer are pregnancy under the age of 25, early menopause, which would be prior to the age of 50, or oral contraceptives. That would decrease the risk of developing ovarian carcinoma. The things that increase the risk are going to be late menopause, nulliparity, age over 30 at first pregnancy, family history, certainly for ovarian, but think also about the risk of some of the other things that we've talked about with breast cancer, endometrial and colorectal carcinomas. BRCA1 and BRCA2 do play a role here, as there are some studies that show that mutation carriers may have a better response to therapy than the non-carriers, which is kind of interesting. So as far as histology goes, here we've kind of got a little bit of a laundry list to go through. We have epithelial tumors, sex cord and stromal tumors, and germ cell tumors. The epithelial tumors are going to be 90% of those, and those get broken down to benign, borderline, those of low malignant potential, or truly malignant. So most of these are going to be kind of in that general category. So as far as borderline ovarian tumors, I can tell you that they only metastasize on the boards. I don't know why, but every case of metastatic borderline ovarian tumors I ever treated was on paper or on a computer screen. It's crazy. So you can just kind of read through. A patient presents with a metastatic borderline ovarian tumor. Just cracks me up. These things have low metastatic potential. Essentially, what you do is you just go in and remove the involved ovary, and that should be sufficient 95% of the time. If it does metastasize or recur, you can go in and reoperate, remove the tumor, and administer chemotherapy just like you do for epithelial ovarian tumors otherwise. So if they give you that, the answer is reoperate and then administer adjuvant therapy. And we'll talk about adjuvant therapy here just in a little bit. Those stromal ovarian tumors, kind of the oddballs, they're more indolent than the epithelial tumors, and they're going to go to surgery for their primary treatment in advanced cases. So if they give you something where, you know, this thing is the size of a cantaloupe and it's invading into contiguous structures and the omentum is involved and all of that stuff, surgery, and then we would consider adjuvant chemotherapy. But that happens so infrequently these days, I think it's going to be really strange if they give you that. Germ cell tumors, well, they're going to go to surgery for the initial diagnosis. They are very aggressive, but you're going to treat them just like the germ cell tumor. So it's going to be bleomycin, etoposide, cisplatin. Primary treatment for those sorts of things. As far as staging goes, it's a detailed surgery with washings of the peritoneum, multiple biopsies, resection of as much tumor as you possibly can. You'll hear the term cytoreductive surgery sometimes used for these. Think in terms of working these people up. You're going to get a CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis. I usually recommend an IVP because they're going to be working near the ureters. It's always nice to know where the ureters are. Sometimes they'll have a urologist come in and just put in a couple of ureteral stents prior to their surgery so that the surgeons can identify it. PET scanning can be effective in this situation as well. CBC biochemical profile, tumor markers. You know, the tumor marker really doesn't help in the diagnosis, but it can help in the management. What if cancer is the answer, tissue is the issue? You've got to have it, in the lab. You've got to really understand what it is. So the test really doesn't help. As far as treatment goes, epithelial ovarian carcinoma is really the one you need to be aware of. Surgery is the primary treatment with ovarian cancer of all stages and types. It assists with diagnosis and management. And here we're talking about cytoreductive surgery. Now, they may give you a case where they take this woman to surgery and it's kind of a peek and shriek, you know, they go in and my goodness, it's everywhere. With our current imaging studies, that really doesn't happen all that often, but it's the boards, so you have to be prepared for things that don't occur commonly. And so they look inside and they see that there's just tumor everywhere. They do a biopsy and close her up. Well, what do you do? Well, if the woman is interested in therapy, if it's her goal to try to do something with that, there's two things that you can do. Number one, get her to a gynecologic oncologist and have her get the best surgery that she can. That's one option. Number two, you can do primary chemotherapy up front. Try to get as much cytoreduction as you can with 3 to 6 cycles of chemotherapy. Then go to the gynecologic oncologist for resection of residual tumor. Either of those is considered permissible. Either way, that's a reasonable option to undertake. In any case, what you want to try to do is to get to a point where you get that patient debulked such that she has less than 2 centimeters of bulk disease left. If you can get her to that point, those women have survivals that are 2 to 4 times that of women who get debulked to anything short of that. So really, our goal is to try to get women the best surgery that we possibly can because it gives them the best chance at longevity. Active agents for chemotherapy include the platinum compound, cyclophosphamide, ifosfamide, the taxanes, and we use some drugs that you probably don't hear of all that much. Melphalan, drug that we use for multiple myeloma a long ways back. Hexamethylmelamine, I just like saying it. It's kind of cool, but it's another agent that we can look at. Doxorubicin, we've got liposomal doxorubicin. Whenever you can, you try to put chemo in a soap bubble, which is essentially what we do with liposomal doxorubicin. And topotecan can be effective as well. As with most tumors, combinations are more active than single agents. Traditionally, what we will do is use a taxane and a platinum. So docetaxel, paclitaxel, carboplatin, cisplatin, it's pretty much under the role of the oncologist, and the oncologist most often is going to look at the situation and try to see what the patient's tolerances are going to be and try to figure out the best approach. But at face value, that's what we're going to wind up doing in a situation like this. It's a value for adjuvant therapy for disease beyond stage one. Intraperitoneal installation of chemotherapy can be of palliative benefit. It kind of goes in and out of vogue. The challenge that we have is that this is a process where you can get a lot of adhesions and things get walled off. And so the intraperitoneal chemotherapy that we deliver doesn't wash through the pelvis in most cases the way we would really like for it to. So that's a challenge that with which we're faced. Hormonal therapy, limited role in all but the most fetal of cases. Radiation can be effective for palliation. So we've talked a little bit about stage one disease. Stage two through four, again, we've outlined it as we've discussed. Here's the overall prognosis. As you can tell, stage one is our best chance that we've got. It gets pretty sad for stage two disease and beyond. Metastatic ovarian tumors, I can pretty much bet they will give you at least one case of metastatic ovarian tumors. 5% of them are metastatic. Most frequently it's from the genital tract, breast, or GI tract. Autopsy studies of women with metastatic breast carcinoma, about 25% of the time the ovaries are going to be involved. The classic example of a Krukenberg tumor was metastatic tumor from the stomach. It was a signet ring adenocarcinoma. Typically, it would come from the stomach, the colon, the breast, the biliary tract, cervix, or bladder. Unfortunately, what it means in virtually every case is a situation where patients are going to wind up dying of their disease from the primary site within a year. So that's kind of